Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour Magazine, GoodMorningQuote.com, and a special 4th of July reading of the book Purple Mountain Majesty by Barbara Younger. And today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. Welcome back. Today's reading from Glamour is just a special one. We had been talking about ways of, you know, what we're doing next year in school, whether you've made the right choice or not. And we also were going to talk about jobs, and if you've landed that summer job or your real job after college or high school or whatever, you know, what happens? This one is called, You Just Got Promoted, Now What? This month's woman in charge, Julie Larson Green of Microsoft, can answer that. By Wendy Noggle. Growing up in rural Washington, Julie Larson Green, 55, had only one computer in her high school. And when she declared in her yearbook she wanted to go into programming, she never used it. She had never used it. Now she's a 24-year veteran at Microsoft and the company's chief experience officer. In other words, the woman has drive. I was the oldest of three girls, so I've always felt like a bossy pants, she says. If you're a new boss or hope to become one, you want her tips. Number one, companies tend to say, this person is really good at doing X, so they should lead people who do X. That's how people get put into this manager role. But it takes a while to learn that you have to change your perspective. You were really good at how to do something. Now your job really starts to become the why. Setting the challenge for your team rather than telling them how to do it. 2. I want to be very open and transparent to set an example. You model behavior as a leader. And the number one thing I have learned about creating work-life balance for the team is to be reliable. I'll say, I've got my kids' soccer, I'm out. Or, I've got ultimate frisbee. That's what my son's really into. Whenever he has a game, I mark it on my calendar and let people know. Then they can work around that. When you're working as a team, it's the unknown, like, where is that person, or why aren't they here? That's a problem. 3. Remember what it feels like to be an employee. You know, what unmotivated you and made you say, I will never do that as a boss? And don't do it. Number 4. I think you need to be fearless and ask for what you want. You shouldn't be afraid to be the only woman in the room. Growing up, I babysat scads of boys. It was like Lord of the Flies, but you get used to it. Lately, I've started calling out things, like if I get talked over. I say, hold on a second, I think you interrupted me. That's important as a boss. Just be very direct, and you will improve the workplace over time. Number 5. Staying on top of everything can be a struggle. I try to categorize the work by asking, is this going to matter in a day, a week, a month, or a year? That prioritizes things. And then I use, quote, productive procrastination for things that aren't going to matter long term. A lot just falls by the wayside. You don't have to focus on everything that comes into your inbox immediately. Do you really need to read the latest crazy thing Trump said? Someone is going to tell you about it. And the last one, number 6, I lead a lot through intuition, which some people say is rapid processing of facts that lead you to a conclusion. But a big part of learning to trust your gut is trying out things with people who aren't going to shut you down. That gives you a sense of, quote, I actually do know what I'm talking about. Imposter syndrome is real for men and women, but sharing your ideas with people who will listen can boost your confidence. And that was from the June 2017 edition of Glamour magazine. Now, seeing that 4th of July is right around the corner, just the middle of next week, I thought I would do something that you might enjoy. And it's a book on the story of Katharine Lee Bates and America the Beautiful. And this is entitled Purple Mountain Majesties by Barbara Younger. Katharine Lee Bates loved words. Stories, rhymes, and clever ways of saying things came quickly to her mind. In 1868, when she was 9 years old, her mother gave her a red leather diary. After inscribing her name, she began, "I am writing, scribbling, rather, just for fun. Not that I have anything to say. There is a charm in bright, clean, unfilled pages, which I, for one, cannot resist." In truth, Katharine had lots to say. She filled those blank pages with her jottings about growing up in the seaside town of Falmouth, Massachusetts. Katharine's father had died when she was a baby, and the family did not have much money. As her older brothers and sisters went to work, Katharine, the youngest, helped out at home and kept on writing. In one story of hers, a character mused, "I would study and study. I would know what makes the beautiful colors around you, dear old setting sun, and I would learn all about the nations on the other side of the globe. I would find out why some poetry is poetry and some isn't, and how my head thinks." Probably Katharine herself felt this way, for she was a witty, imaginative student. With a loan from her brother Arthur, she was able to attend a new college for women called Wellesley. By the time she graduated, she had sold some poems and stories. Later, she returned to Wellesley to teach English literature. She wrote poetry all her life, and she did travel to the British Isles, Europe, Egypt, and the Middle East. In 1893, when Katharine was 34, she was invited to lecture out west for 3 weeks in July at a college in Colorado Springs. She accepted eagerly. The extra money would be useful, for by now Katharine was helping to support her mother and sister, and she was glad for the chance to see more of her own country. Of course, she took along her diary and her writing notebooks. As she settled herself in the train, she must have wondered what adventures the trip would bring. Quote, "Left Boston on Fitchburg Road at 3 p.m., she wrote in her diary. She surely did not guess all that lay in store. The following day, the train stopped at Niagara Falls. Katharine watched and listened as rivers of water roared and pounded and plunged. On the train that night, she noted, the glory and music of Niagara Falls. She also wrote a poem about the falls, ending with the lines, "Columnar mist and glistening rainbow play, a splendid thrill of glory and of peril." When the train reached Chicago, Katharine was able to spend the weekend with her good friend Katharine Coman, whose family lived in nearby Oak Park. The two women had met at Wellesley, where Miss Coman taught history and economics. Firmly committed to women's education, they were to become close lifelong friends and traveling companions. "We were merry together," Katharine once said. Katharine respected the social activism of Miss Coman, who came from an Ohio abolitionist family, and who wrote, spoke, and organized to improve the conditions of immigrant women laboring in factories and sweatshops. Her friend had a, quote, "westering heart." Katharine wrote, quote, "a vigorous and adventurous personality." Miss Coman appreciated Katharine's poetry, her devotion to her students, and her vision for a better world. Catherine believed that each person's life held great possibilities. "Dare to dream. Spirit outsoars space," she urged in one of her poems. Also, blessed with a sense of whimsy, Catherine named her bicycle Lucifer. Often hummed to herself, penned stories and poems for children, read dog books to her own dog, and even hosted a party for parrots on her back steps. Miss Coleman also planned to teach in Colorado Springs that summer, but for now, the two caught up on each other's news and visited friends. Then they went to a fair. The fair wasn't just any fair. It was the World's Columbian Exposition, celebrating the 400 years that had passed since Christopher Columbus's voyage to the New World. Once the fair was over, the grand-looking buildings, which were made of only thin white plaster, would be taken down. But for now, it all gleamed like a magnificent alabaster city. Catherine never forgot it. The purpose of the fair was to show what a great nation had grown up in America. Each state had created a display of its own special industries and foods. The California building featured a knight made entirely of prunes. There were also buildings boasting new machinery, new transportation vehicles, and new inventions such as the zipper. At the Palace of Electricity, many felt the glow of their first electric lamp. In the Anthropological Building, a life-size model of the great Siberian mammoth stared down at visitors. The nations of the world set up exhibits, too. The two Catherines admired the dress of people from distant lands. Impressive though it all was, sadly, the fair also reflected the prejudices of the times. African Americans were provided refreshments and restrooms only in the Haiti building. Native Americans appeared in a sideshow, and no women had been invited to participate in planning the fair. After considerable protest, they were allowed to erect their own building, which they did splendidly with the help of an architect from Boston named Sophia Hayden. In the distance towered the Wheel, designed by the young engineer George Washington Ferris. Some folks were afraid to ride it, but not the two friends. Time was short, however, so the ride would have to wait until they returned. The fair, a thing of beauty, off again at 6 p.m., Catherine noted. The next day, which was the 4th of July, Catherine's New England eyes delighted in the rich amber wheat fields of the Great Plains rolling by her window. Hot Sirocco run across western Kansas. She wrote in her diary, calling herself a better American for such a fourth. As the train sped west, she also turned to her notebooks. Her busy schedule had taught her to write in bits and snatches, her poems often coming by accident in spare moments. Catherine arrived in Colorado Springs, tired and a bit homesick, but after a few days' rest, she was ready to teach. In her free time, her hosts took her sightseeing in the canyons, valleys, and bluffs of the Rocky Mountains. She explored the Garden of the Gods, where huge red rock formations jutted out of the earth in intriguing shapes. People had given them fanciful names, kissing camels, sleeping giant, seal and bear, cathedral spires, and balanced rock. She saw shimmering lakes, plummeting waterfalls, and heard coyotes howl by moonlight. Once, when a mountain road collapsed just as her wagon passed, she had to spend the night in a gold mining boom town called Cripple Creek, with no baggage along except a book of poetry. She also visited the grave of Helen Hunt Jackson, who had written about the government's injustice toward Native Americans. One day, Catherine and a group of teachers set out for the top of Pike's Peak, a famous mountain that reached over 2.5 miles into the clouds. The rough dirt road did not go straight up, but followed a long and twisty route with frightening hairpin turns. Now and then a wagon did tip over, despite the driver's skill. Local people liked to joke that the drivers didn't need their monthly salaries. Relieved tourists, grateful to be back down safely, made such generous tippers. The teachers took a train to the base of the mountain. Then the merry group piled into prairie wagons, emblazoned with the slogan, "Pike's Peak or Bust!" Halfway up, the driver stopped at a place called the Halfway House and exchanged the tired horses for sturdy mules. The wagons turned on up and up as the pine woods gave way to spare, dead white stems, a ghostly forest. Then rocky land, and finally the summit. Catherine stood and gazed out at the sea-like expanse of fertile plains below her. She felt the giant arc of the ample skies above. In the distance, the Rockies shone purple in the sun. At that moment, the opening lines of a poem floated into her mind. But no sooner had the words come to her than two teachers began to faint from the altitude. "Quick, into the wagons," the drivers called. So Catherine had only one brief ecstatic glimpse from the top of Pike's Peak. "Pike's Peak or bust," Catherine noted in her diary that evening. "Most glorious scenery I ever beheld." Into her notebook, she penciled the lines of poetry that had come to her that day. "Oh, beautiful for halcyon skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the enameled plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee." Catherine sat working on more verses. As she wrote, she remembered her train ride across the country. She thought about the glory of the land and about the courageous pioneers who had struggled west in covered wagons to make new lives. She thought about her own forebears who had crossed the rough Atlantic. She remembered the Civil War, which had been fought during her childhood to end slavery and keep the nation whole. She recalled the progress and ingenuity exhibited at the fair. But Catherine knew that beyond that gleaming white city was another city, a Chicago crowded with hunger and gloom. She had seen that, too. America was in an economic depression that year. Banks had closed, workers were striking, people needed help. Catherine wrote about a time when, quote, "selfish gain would, quote, no longer stain her country." One of her verses went, "Oh, beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years. Thine alabaster cities gleam, undimmed by human tears." She knew that it was not always easy to be fair and loving and to share with others, but her poem envisioned a country where people would join together out of their best selves to make life better for everyone. After summer school was finished, Catherine headed east, stopping once more in Chicago. Again, she and Catherine Coleman visited the fair. This time, they rode Mr. Ferris's wheel. In early August, Catherine arrived back in Wellesley. "Reached home for tea," she jotted. Soon she was busy teaching and laid aside her notebooks from the trip. She wasn't particularly pleased with the poetry she had written that summer. "Consider my verses disheartening," she noted in her diary. Two summers later, she came across the Pike's Peak poem and decided to send it to a magazine called The Congregationalist. The editor liked it and printed it in the July 4th issue. Lots of other people liked the poem too. Almost immediately, it was set to many different tunes, even to a march. Soon, schools, churches, synagogues, scout troops, and clubs throughout the land were singing Catherine's poem, which was now known as America the Beautiful. It was even translated so that immigrants new to America could sing it in their own language. Catherine revised her hymn, as she called it, several times, to make some phrases more simple and direct, and a bit more musical. After many years, a contest was held to choose the perfect music, but none of the 900 entries seemed just right to the judges. A hymn composed by Samuel Ward is the music we sing today. As the song gained popularity, people from far and near came to Wellesley to meet Catherine Lee Bates. Over and over, she was asked to tell the story of the bumpy ride up the mountain and her moment's glimpse from the top of Pike's Peak. She often invited visitors to stay for tea and to meet her collie dog and parrot, and she showed children treasures from her travels. When Congress set out to select a national anthem, many citizens wanted America the Beautiful instead of the Star-Spangled Banner. Even now, many Americans would vote for Catherine's song. Over the years, Catherine received hundreds of letters about A, the B, as her family nicknamed it. She did her best to answer them, even writing the words out in longhand for a grandfather who wanted copies for each of his 10 grandchildren. Reporters often asked for interviews. One commented that Catherine seemed to want to talk more about her pets than about her celebrated song. People were forever suggesting small changes to Catherine's verses. One common request was that she add a stanza expressing international brotherhood or unity among all nations on earth. Saying her song was long enough, Catherine had an interesting solution. Quote, "When you sing, think of from sea to shining sea as applying from the Pacific to the Atlantic, around the other way, and that will include all the nations and all the people." Aside from the money she received when the poem was first published, Catherine never requested payment for its use. She once told a group of teachers, "It is not work to write a song. It is great joy." And I think it is befitting for the Thursday before the 4th of July for us to consider the words to America the Beautiful. If you haven't heard it in its entirety, here it is. America the Beautiful. Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. O beautiful for pilgrim feet, whose stern, impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. O beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved, and mercy more than life. America, America, may God thy gold refine, till all success be nobleness, and every gain divine. O beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years, thine alabaster cities gleam, undimmed by human tears. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. I hope you enjoyed that and could kind of envision our country with all its beauty, both geographic as well as the people that live within our country. And because Father's Day was just, a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to just read a quick quote from, goodmorningquote.com on fathers, and this is what it says. Fathers, be your daughter's first love. Open doors for her, pull her seat out, and talk to, treat her with the utmost respect. Set expectations on how a man should treat a lady, and she'll never settle for anything less. I wonder if you have a journal or a notebook that you write things in, and doesn't have to be at any particular set time, but just kind of when things come to you. We've had a couple of themes today, one being jobs, and the other being America, and how the America the Beautiful was written, and the other being dads right now. Lots of things to consider. And it's sometimes just good to kind of talk about or write about these things that are on your mind, be they these themes or other themes. But good to kind of think about what do you think about jobs? What kind of job would you want? What kind of a leader would you want to be? What are your thoughts on America? What are some of the problems? What are some of the absolute beauties, beautiful points and parts of our country? What do you love about our country? And finally, about your dad. What do you love about your dad? All right. If you have any questions or any comments or anything, do call us. I'd love to hear from you. And maybe we can talk about it next time. All right. Well, I want to wish you a great week. We have come to the end of our program right now. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Annika Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. So long, until next time. Have a wonderful 4th of July. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.